then I wound up going into a rehab up in Northern California. And the first time I heard Take Me Home Tonight, I was doing the dishes in a rehab, and it was coming through this little speaker on the radio, and I said, what's wrong with this picture?
I want to go back, cause I feel it so much older, but I can't go back, I know.
Everything that I bought in the house, whether it be a nightstand or a coffee table, was made of glass, so I could shop blow on it. And I realize now that everything I bought was something that I could usually just use at my disposal, you know? I don't buy anything with glass on it anymore.
If I could walk on water, would you believe in me? My love is so true.
What's happening, gang? This is the Money Man. That's right, Eddie Money in the studio. I was doing a lot of heavy drinking, and one night I went out to a so-called friend of mine. He wasn't really a friend at all, and I thought I was snorting some blow because I was, you know, I was really drunk and I wanted to drive home, and it turned out to be a phenytoin, which is a bathtub barbiturate, and it knocked me out, put me into a coma, and I went into a coma on my leg, and the nerve felt, the sciatic nerve on my left leg fell asleep, and it knocked out the sciatic nerve, which is actually the longest nerve in your body. It goes from your hip to your leg. Something, I don't really know what happened. All I know is I woke up, you know, with tubes coming out of me, and I woke up and I tried to crawl out of the hospital because I was due to do Trinidad on solid gold. of course, I never made it. Trinidad would have been a great hit single for that record to turn the whole thing around. And I was determined to, you know, because I was always very popular on the road due to AOR radio and due to my reputation. And naturally, Trinidad didn't happen, and the record sales were really bad. And then the doctors told me I was never going to walk again. And I couldn't believe it. I said, well, who's going to pay the bills if I never walk? And, like, I was given up for dead. I had a 40% chance of living, no less walking. And when I got out of the hospital, I spent about a year and a half of really so much therapy. It was crazy. Unfortunately, I didn't take any mental therapy. I just took physical therapy because I went back out after that. And when I made the album No Control, Tom Dowd was a great producer. And I had this one guy come over and twist me up like a pretzel and work on my leg and try to get the blood thrown, try to get me to move my toes and stuff like that. And it was a very long, hard, tragic road. When I wrote the album No Control, I used to walk with a walker, like a little old lady, a walker from my bedroom to the music room to write that album. And then I finally started walking again, and before I knew it, I started, you know, one day I decided to run on the beach, and everybody was just so flipped out, and, you know, and the thing is, like, I wasn't going to let people tell me that I was never going to walk again, and because, you know, I wanted to, you know, I had a very strong constitution, and I wanted to, not only did I want to walk again, I wanted to dance again. And people said it was impossible, you know. And I had a miraculous comeback, you know. And I want to thank God for that. And I want to thank my ex-wife for that. And I want to thank CBS Records for still standing behind me. And Bill Graham was still a great manager. And it was a really tough period in my life. It really was. But and Tom Dowd was a great producer. And when we made No Control, they said the record would never go platinum. And I said, I'll bet you $500 that record goes platinum, because I had so many fans out there. Now, Shaken wasn't really a big hit. It only got to number 66 on the CHR charts, but everybody in the world knows Shaken, and songs like No Control. I mean, I'd play No Control live, and I was the man with No Control. This was before Guns N' Roses, and this was before a lot of people that think they get out there. I mean, I was, you know, the guy that could stay up longer than anybody, drink anybody under the table, have more girlfriends than anybody else, and still get out there and do a dynamite show and get four encores. And people couldn't understand it. But this is my will. This was just this Eddie Money character that I used to let out of a cage. Like my mother calls me the Dorian Gray of rock and roll. And it was very crazy.
Can't believe it's turned. It turned my life apart now.
answer. Here I am standing in circles, and the logic is turning me round. My mind keeps holding only one thought. When you gonna call? I think it's worth the time. How are you gonna change all these endless nights? If you could stop leading me around, never gonna change all these endless nights. Tender, the way that you touch me now, taking up tears away now. There won't be a reason, just a well-rehearsed explanation.
Yeah, it's great. It's a great, very romantic tune. When you gonna call this worth the time? I love that tune. Of course, it's not one of my greatest hits, which is why I didn't make the greatest hits album. We do a great live version of that song, Redbeard. When I get back into Dallas, or you get a chance to see me on the road, I do that song a lot different than the studio version, and it just brings the house down. And when I started getting better, you know, coming around again. You know, the funny thing is, it's the doctor that had this one doctor said to me, you know, all these doctors told me I was never going to walk again. Then I went to this doctor in San Francisco who dealt with a lot of really low-life people and a lot of dope addicts and stuff. He says to me, you know, he says, you'll walk again. He says, you'll be hobbling around copping in a year. And I thought he was crazy. I said to myself, man, that guy's what? I'm never going to do heavy drugs again. And sure enough, a year later, it was ironic, man. It was like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. There I was with a cane on some street corner, copping again. And then I made Where's the Party, which was a good record. But I just gradually started getting back into doing a lot of drinking, a lot of womanizing, and eventually a lot of drugs. And I just... it just, you know, the whole thing started happening all over again, man. So, you know, I just got to, basically speaking, I know that I'm an addict and I know that I'm an alcoholic. I mean, there's no such thing as casually having a drink for me. And there's no such thing as casually smoking a joint or doing a line of blow. It's like, you know, in 2 or 3 weeks, I'll go completely back out there again, you know, and I'll be worse off than I am right now. For me, you know, I never wear my sobriety on my shoulder. You know what I mean? You can't tell young people what to do, because I never really listen to anybody. It's like the Newton law of gravity. You know, you jump out of a boat, the further you jump, the further the boat goes back. It's like, you know, it's like the album No Control was a very prolific album for me, like songs like Passing by the Graveyard, because I knew John Belushi personally, or songs like No Control. It's telling people that you don't have to be rich and famous to kill yourself. You know what I mean? You don't have to be a rock star to do a couple of pills or drink too much booze, pass out, and not only kill yourself, but kill your girlfriend and three people in the back seat. There are very rich, I know a lot of rich people that are recovering from, you know, like I know David Crosby, you know, well, and I know the guys in Aerosmith, and the guys in Motley Crue. These are friends of mine, and, you know, we've all been through the worst of it. I mean, the very worst of it, you know, like killing somebody, you know, like if they lose your bindle. It's like, and you never think that you're going to turn into this character that drugs and booze turns you into. But it's just like, it happens, man. And you know, if you, you know, and if you don't have the money to get it, you'll steal, you know, it's crazy too. And believe me, I used to love to get high, but, you know, from my standpoint right now, it's just like, for me, it just didn't work. You know, it's because it's bad for your health. It's bad for your career. And if I could go out and casually have a beer at a football game or casually, you know, smoke a joint, which I don't advocate any of that anymore, I'd be okay. But I mean, like, when you're into rock and roll and you did as many drugs as I did and you drank as much as I did, it's just like, you just can't go backwards, man. It's like, you know, when people say to me, you know, you want something, I just say to them, look, I've had enough, because I've had, you know.
Has run dry. I'm staring at an empty space. The feeling's all over, gone without a trace. Oh, one moment held by a thread, one time to hold.
Baby, go on this way.
All
get out of the rain.
Well, I was going to make an album after Where's the Party, but they didn't have any decent equipment at a rehab. No, actually, after Where's the Party, I thought the record was a great record. And I went on the road on Where's the Party and played Big Crash and played Where's the Party and played Leave It to Me. And I thought it was a great album. It just didn't get the, you know, because I was so crazy. I didn't really get the shot that I probably didn't really deserve. You know, I had a lot of people that weren't really taking me seriously. But I was still making enough money, and I had a great manager, Bill Graham, that I was still on the road opening up a lot of people and also playing headline gigs. And I was just like, I was out there working. I was just out there like, or, you know, I was... People didn't hear from me from an album point of view, but I was still working gigs. I mean, I came through Dallas. I came through Houston. I mean, I was still on the road, and I wasn't doing clubs. I can't remember who I was opening up. I was opening up some people. You know, I was still out there making money, and I was making enough money to get totally strung out and totally messed up. And then when I started making the Can't Hold Back album, I started to realize that I was a dope addict and that I was an alcoholic. And I went into a rehab, and I got myself pretty together. But I was in a spiritual program, but I wasn't really following the steps, so to speak. And after about 6 or 7, I made that record pretty clean. But then after I went back out on the road, there was all the girls again, and then there was the blow, and then there was the booze, and there was all my buddies that I was partying with for 10 years in Houston and Dallas and Cleveland and Detroit and New York City, and I just turned into the animal that I was before I went into the rehab, and I started getting back out there again. And then I met Lori. I lost a beautiful wife due to my using, and we broke up, and I met Lori, and we were going to have a baby. And I was getting high, and she went into a forced labor, and she wanted me in the room when she had the baby. And we didn't take Lamaze. When she had the baby, she thought Lamaze was like a French cooking class, you know? So she went into forced labor, and I was stoned on a couple of joints. And I said to myself, wow, what if she has a baby and there's something wrong with the baby? And I went back, and I went back into a program. And for the first time in my life, I really started thinking about, you know, I'm going to be raising a family now. I've got a lot of people out there, a lot of friends and a lot of fans out there that would love to see me do great. That would, you know, that don't want to see a Jim Morrison or a Janis Joplin or a Jimi Hendrix story. You know what I mean? And I started to realize how important my life was and how important my career was and how important my life was with Lori and how important it is to, like, you know, to bring a kid into the world. And, Lori had a little boy who I'm raising now. His name is Zachary. He's my son now. And he was 2 years old. And I just didn't want to be using drugs around my kids. And I didn't want to be drinking. And I had a lot of flaky friends that I wanted to get rid of. And it just I just straightened my life out. And, you know, I still got to keep it in check because there's something inside of me that would say, well, you know, I'd love to have a beer today, or, you know, I'd love to have a drink, or, you know, I'd love to smoke a joint. But if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. And I'd much rather be part of the solution. And I don't want my kids growing up using drugs and drinking and messing up and making the same mistakes that I made. You know what I mean? I'd rather be a good example I think that a rock performer has an obligation, since there's a lot of people look up to rock performers as being something that people can look up to, you know, like Mickey Mantle in the early 60s. Well, I had written a lot of songs, and I was, you know, even when I was getting loaded, but when I wasn't on the road, I was always like, you know, I was helping a lot of people out that didn't have record deals, the people that didn't have a CBS to back them, people didn't have a Bill Graham as a manager. And I had worked with people like Ron Nevison, who had done the Rolling Stones, he did The Who, he did Led Zeppelin. I was working with Andy Johns, one of the greatest engineers in the world, who had done the same. And I'd worked with people like Bruce Botnick, who have done The Doors. And I had all this input that great producers had given me. And I started producing myself, and I started producing groups that didn't have record contracts. And I was back in the studio, and all of a sudden I started cleaning my act up together, and I started doing a lot of writing. I started doing, like, you know, Bring on the Rain and Can't Hold Back, and One Love. I think those are all great songs. And I just started really really getting into, you know, getting into what I should be doing, which is, you know, like God gave me a great gift, you know, the opportunity to sing, and also, you know, the brains to transform something that comes from my mind, you know, to be a prolific writer. So I just started writing a lot of material. I got together with Richie Zito, who's a brand new producer. Since then, he brought Cheap Trick back. He's gone platinum with me. He's gone platinum with Cheap Trick. Then he did just finished Bad English. Now he's working with Hart. We became really good friends. We work well together. And I just started taking my life, I started looking at life a lot more professionally. You know, like the whole thing wasn't a big party anymore. It's like, you know, I've got something to do. And rather than spending $500,000 to $750,000 getting around to it, I got to the point where, you know, money became important to me for the aspect that what I don't spend on the record, I could, you know, I could give to my parents, or I could, you know, I could pay a house payment for a change and do something ridiculous. All of a sudden, my, you know, responsibilities started creeping into my life. And I think that record is when I started really cleaning my life up. But as soon as the record started doing great, as soon as I finished the record, I stayed straight making the album, but as soon as the record was done, I felt like I deserved the reward. So I went back out there and started getting really high again. And then I wound up going into a rehab up in Northern California. And the first time I heard Take Me Home Tonight, I was doing the dishes in a rehab, and it was coming through this little speaker on the radio, and I said, "What's wrong with this picture?" So then I slowly and gradually started changing my life around and you know, becoming the person I am today, you know.
Sit on each other.
Hi, gang, this is Money Man. That's right, Eddie Money in the studio. Well, Take Me Home Tonight to me was a great tune. But to me, I felt kind of silly singing it because here I was about, I don't know, I was in my early 30s, and it seemed like a real bubblegum chorus to me. Take me home tonight, I don't want to, you know, see the, until they see the light. And I'm going, God, this sounds like something that the Bay City Rollers would do. Then I started thinking about the Be My Little Baby part, and I was always a big fan of Ronnie Spector's when I was a real little kid, because she did, you know, Be My Little, the original Be My Little Baby. And originally they were going to, and there was, and it said, just like Ronnie sang, I said, they've got to be talking about Ronnie Spector. And sure enough, they were. And I said to Richie, you know, why don't we call Ronnie? And they said, well, we don't know where Ronnie Spector is. You know, her career's been done. Well, I persisted, and I really followed through on my instincts. And I got her on the phone. I said, Ronnie, what are you doing? And she's married now. She's got a couple of kids. She says, I'm doing the dishes. I says, well, this is Eddie Money. And she knew who I was. She was a fan. And I said, I think this song's a great tribute to you. And I'd love you to come out to California. I sent the first class tickets. And, you know, I gave her a limousine when she got to the airport. And I gave her some beautiful, you know, roses for the car. Because I had to treat a real star. And when I met Ronnie in the studio, it was kind of like a little kid meeting Jose Canseco. You know, I was like shaking. Because, you know, she was one of my idols when I was a kid growing up. She's fantastic. You know, she's partied with people like the Rolling Stones and the Beatles. And she was married to that maniac, Phil Spector. I don't know how she did that. So, you know, she's really been through her own major crises, you know, but she still sings great. And as a matter of fact, the last record didn't really fare that well. I really wanted to get in there and help her produce that album, but I was so busy with my own career, I didn't have the chance to do that. And she came in and she sang, and she turned that song into a magical track. I mean, to me, the combination of me and her on that song, and to revitalize her career, and to also revitalize my own career, there was something really magical about the whole thing, and it just worked so well. It just really gelled, and she's just a fine lady. She still looks fantastic, and, you know, people say to me that I brought Ronnie Spector's career back. I don't look at it that way. I think that Ronnie's career helped reestablish my own career.
I wanna go back.
Well, you know what? Billy Satellite was some very good friends of mine. They were from the Bay Area. A writer named Monty Byron, who's a great writer and a great singer, wrote that song, Want to Go Back. And we used to perform in clubs together back in the early 70s. So I know Monty really well. As a matter of fact, we're working together on my new record. We've been writing some songs together. And that song really rang a bell with me with the verse, I recall hanging out on Friday night, the first slow dance, hoping then I get it right. I said, God, that is song, that's got to be the tune to do for me. Now, when I originally cut the song, Monty sang the song on a demo before he got signed to Capitol. And when he did the song for Capitol, I think he destroyed it. You know, he went in there with a producer, and they meddled with it, and they messed it up. It's kind of like everybody's career sometimes is beat the demo. And I went in there, and I copied the song, and I copied the way he sang it. Now, he swears that I kill him on the vocal. But in my opinion, nobody can sing a song better than if they wrote it themselves. Now, I think Monty kills me on it, but everybody in the world says I sing it better than Monty. I beg to differ. I think he did a fantastic job singing it. Not so much on his version that he put on a record, but on the demo. And we became really good friends. And I want to go back. I was starting to get a little older, and I just realized that I was famous, and you know, my wheels were turning, and all of a sudden, not that I wanted to be young again, but it's just like I thought it was a song that everybody could relate to. I think the song would have been a bigger hit, but I think a lot of people, you know, that are just getting out of high school, or, you know, a lot of fans of mine that, you know, have since been married. I mean, the craziest thing in the world is to meet people that have been coming to my shows for 12 years, and now they're introducing me to their children. And I'm going, wow, man, all of a sudden, you know, with little Eddie Money t-shirts on them. And they've got an Eddie Money t-shirt on it with like moth holes in it that they got in 1977, and their kids got a brand new, you know, Nothing to Lose t-shirt on. And I'm going, God, I said, why don't you get yourself a new t-shirt? But it's great because, you know, when I went out with Cyndi Lauper, you know, she had so many young fans, and I went out with her on the Can't Hold Back album. And she had Girls Just Want to Have Fun, and she had a great record, and we went out with her, and I had Take Me Home Tonight. And because of she had a very young following, you know, I developed a lot of new fans that still come to my shows. Man, when you were in rock and roll, you never grow up. You know, like the trouble is with me, I could turn around and, like, you know, get on a microphone and still think I'm 14 or 15 years old. You know, carefree with a couple of chicks in the audience and playing it nice and loud. It's like, you know, you don't really have the last real job I had was typing on the police department. That was like 20 years ago. I mean, you know, and then I worked at JCPenney's as a receiving clerk, and I quit that, and what did I do? I wound up getting a job as a pants salesman in Berkeley back in 1969, and that's when President Reagan was the governor of the state of California, and all of a sudden People's Park was right down the street, and, you know, they came in with the pepper gas, and, like, the whole town was in an uproar, and, man, it was wild. I mean, I was in Berkeley during the riots and stuff like that. It was, when I was growing up, you know, it was just really an amazing time to be growing up. Like, my mother bought me a 10-speed, and she saw me behind Dan Rathers on the national news, riding behind him on Sproul Plaza, waving to my friends. I mean, it was wild. It was really crazy. I wouldn't want to trade it for the world. I just wish that, but everybody really got out there, you know. But now drugs have become such a capitalistic thing, you know. I hate to see people make money selling drugs. And, like, you know, when I was smoking pot, everybody was smoking pot. It was the thing, you know, it was cool. Of course, you know, after a while, you smoke so much pot that you don't want to do anything unless you're singing in a rock band. Then all you got to do is have a couple of drinks and get up there until, you know, it's your life becomes a fantasy. You know, you don't have any responsibilities, and it can definitely retard your growth process. You know what I mean? Like, my mother's still waiting for me to grow up, you know. I mean, I'll hang out and watch people get high. I mean, it doesn't make me uncomfortable. It's just that I know I'd rather be in a situation where I wasn't around that, but I'm not the kind of guy that will, you know, that'll say, you know, don't have a drink in front of me. You know, I mean, I stay away from people, you know, using blow, and I stay away from people smoking pot because I don't want to get popped with them, because I don't want people to think I'm using again, because I'm finally out of debt, you know. I want to keep it that way.
We should be sleeping now.
Welcome back. This is the Money Man. That's right, Eddie Money with Redbeard in the studio. Well, We Should Be Sleeping is about when I quit getting high. And We Should Be Sleeping, tables are turning, it's breaking my heart. 4 in the morning, still got the lights and the radio on. It's about staying up, drinking, and doing whatever you would be doing to write tunes, you know. I mean, I don't write that way anymore, you know. It's like, you know, but We Should Be Sleeping is like, you know, I'm making you promises I know I'd keep, you know. It's like, you know, it's like, it was a song I wrote to my wife about, you know, about quitting using, you know. But I couldn't really stop using drugs or drinking without some help, you know. So We Should Be Sleeping is about being addicted. It's like no control, a big crash, you know, or Call On Me. You remember that song Call On Me on the second record with Jimmy Lyon on guitar? When you're tired and feeling weak and your body cries out for more, well, call on me because I never sleep and I still got the key to your door. I mean, it seems like I wrote so many songs about staying up all night. It's amazing. I remember in the old days, every time I bought furniture when I was married to my wife, everything that I bought in the house, whether it be a nightstand or a coffee table, was made of glass so I could shop blow on it.
Wow.
And I realize now that everything I bought was something that I could usually just use at my disposal, you know? I don't buy anything with glass on it anymore.
Well, if I could walk on water, and if I could find some way to prove, if I could walk on water, would you believe in me? My love is so true. So you said, just one more chance is all you get. Didn't mean to do you wrong again. Worse things have been done by better men. Baby, baby, don't treat me this way. How long have I got to pay now? I'm still paying. Well, if I could walk on water, and if I could find, if I could walk on water, would you believe?
I started, you know, Jesse Holmes, I've known he was a keyboard player. I used to play with Sammy Hagar. He was a really good friend of mine in the Bay Area. We've been friends a long, long time. And the song was a great song, and it just it fit my personality. Well, I'm no angel, I admit. I made a few bad moves that I'm sure I'll regret. It's like the song was tailor-made for my personality and for my vocal range. And we rearranged and came in, and we started off with the chorus first. And the na-na-na-na parts remind me of, like, the whoa-whoa-whoa-whoa parts in Two Tickets to Paradise, you know, or the shaking, whoa-whoa-whoa. The thing is, like, in my earlier, always in my material, it's like the all the na-na-na-nas and the whoa-whoa-whoa-whoas that you hear in the Two Tickets, or that you'll hear in Maybe I'm a Fool, or if you hear in Walk on Water, they're originally, like, horn parts. When I wasn't really that good a horn player, and I'd sing them rather than, because Tom Scott wasn't available. You know, like the whoa, 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 whoa. That was originally supposed to be a horn part, but Tom Scott didn't show up that night, so he made it a vocal part, and it became part of my trademark. You know, a lot of you know, sing-along parts with no lyrics to it. You know what I mean? And when I came in with Jesse, I made sure that was a dominant part of the song, like the na 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 na. It was an important part of the song, and I wanted to make sure that it really rang true. And I'm glad to say that song was a big hit, because it was great to go out and take Jesse to dinner and have people take Jesse out, and all of a sudden Jesse was in the same place in space and time that I was. All of a sudden he was famous, and I said, Jesse, next time you go out, you better start ironing your shirts. Because these people are taking you out because you're famous now. We're not playing cards. Actually, Peace and Our Time is written by a guy named Andy Hill. He's a great writer from England. He became a friend of mine in the last couple of years. And I wanted to do something during the holidays, and I didn't want to do something like Santa Claus is Coming to Town, like Bruce Springsteen. And I was going to do Merry Christmas, Baby, but Otis Redding already did that. I was looking for a tune that reflected, like, you know, what the world would really want, which is Peace in Our Time. And when I got the lyric, never going to break down the wall and build a prison with the stone, it really reminded me of the Berlin Wall and the people in Eastern Europe. And all of a sudden, things just started to click. And then I put the record out, and 2 weeks later, the Berlin Wall started coming down. So for once in my life, the timing was on my side, you know? I don't have any friends in the UN or anything else like that. But I had a feeling, you know, with Gorbachev coming in like that and things changing so much radically in Europe in the last 3 or 4 years, I had a feeling something like this was going to happen. It was a premonition on my part, and I guess we all lucked out. Because I'm sure everybody in Eastern Europe is going to have a way better Christmas than they did last year. I'd like to own a neon sign company on the border of Berlin right now, huh? Can you imagine all the money I can make in Eastern Europe? Eddie Money Signs. I'm on a campaign to get my dog off generic dog food, you know?
Oh, darling, how strong is love supposed to be? Surrounded by fire and magic, we long to be free. It's heating up down on the streets, it's a shame. To be strong in love, to fly with our love like a phoenix from the flame. Gotta have faith, to work it out, faith and hope. Without a doubt, give us strength. Make a start, put a song in our hearts. Never gonna break down the walls and build a prison with the stone. But you and I know what love is worth. We're gonna build a heaven on earth. We're running in the wheels of fortune, turning water into wine. We're gonna make fast, faith and hope. If you let it last, give us strength to reach the stars, put a song on.
Redbeard, man, it's been a great interview. Well, thank you, Redbeard. I'm doing my best to maintain, you know what I mean? I would love to go out and you know, get high again, but it's just too late. I tell everybody, I've had enough, you know?
Right.
And now I'm buying a house out in suburbia. I don't believe it. It's just like, but you know what? I'll tell you something. I'm 40 years old, and I just figured it was time for me to start having some kids, you know?
Yeah.
So I just stepped into this beautiful lady who already had a son. And I've been with her. A couple of years.
That's neat, man.
You know,
she's a year and a half.
Oh, what's your name?
Jessica.
Oh, that's pretty, man.
Yeah, she's a dog. I got another one on the way in April.
Oh man, that's great.
I don't know what happened, man. I went from a quarter ounce a day to having babies. Yeah, I mean, I got a box of Kleenexes here, and I haven't even used one. Hey, have a great holiday, Redbeard, and take care of yourself, huh?